He turned back to Ridcully. "Mind how you go, Arch-Chancellor." He departed, watchmen falling into place behind him.
"Well, now, I suspect the good commander has a lot on his mind these days," said Arch-Chancellor Henry brightly. He pulled out his watch. "I would like to speak to the team captains."
"Well, I know I'm one of them," said Ridcully.
A man stepped forward from the ranks of United.
"Joseph Hoggett of the Pork Backers, as it happens. Captain for my sins."
Hoggett held out his hand to Ridcully, and, to his credit, hardly winced when it was taken in a firm handshake.
"Well, gentlemen," said the former dean, "I am sure you know the rules. We've been through them often enough. I want a good, clean game. One long air peep from my whistle means that I'm interrupting play for an infringement or injury or for some other reason at that point known only to myself. One even longer peep, which I suppose will be more of a parp, will mean the end of one half and time for refreshment, after which the game will recommence. During the interval, I believe that there will be a marching display by the Ankh Morpork Accordion Band, but I suppose these things are sent to try us. May I remind you, gentlemen, that you change ends at the half-time. Also, please impress on your team that the goal they are aiming for should not be behind them. If I see any serious infringement, that player will be removed from the pitch. A considerably longer parp, which, as far as I'm concerned, will continue until I am out of breath, will mark the end of the game. May I also remind you, as Commander Vimes has reminded us, that within these four rather sticky lines of chalk, I am a wielder of power second only to the gods themselves, and then only perhaps. If at any time it becomes clear that the rules themselves are impractical, I will change them. When I blow the whistle, I shall raise my staff and unleash a spell which will prevent any further magic being used within these hallowed lines until the close of play. Is that understood?"
"Yes, sir," said Mr. Hoggett.
"Mostrom," said the former dean, in a meaningful voice.
"Yes, yes, all right," grumbled Ridcully. "You are making the most of your little moment, aren't you? Let's get on with it, shall we?
Gentlemen, would you please form up your teams for the singing of the national anthem? Mr. Stibbons, I believe you have found me a megaphone, thank you very much."
He raised the horn to his lips and shouted through it,
"Ladies and gentlemen, be upstanding for the national anthem."
The singing of the national anthem was always a ragged affair, the good people of Ankh Morpork feeling that it was unpatriotic to sing songs about how patriotic you were, taking the view that someone singing a song about how patriotic they were was either up to something or ahead of state, i.e., up to something. An additional problem today lay in the acoustics of the arena, which were rather too good, coupled with the fact that the speed of sound at one end of the stadium was slightly off-beat compared with the other end, a drawback exacerbated when both sides tried to recover the gap. These acoustical anomalies did not count for much if you were standing next to Mustrum Ridcully, as the Arch-Chancellor was one of those gentlemen who will sing it beautifully, correctly enunciated, and very, very loudly.
"When dragons belch and hippos flee, my thoughts, Ankh Morpork, are of thee,"
he began. Trev noticed, to his surprise, that Nutt was standing stiffly to attention. His own mouth operating on automatic, he looked along the massed rank of Ankh Morpork United. About 50-50, he thought. Half of them decent old cloggers, and half of them Andy and his chums. His gaze lighted on Andy just as he thought that, and Andy flashed him a little smile and pointed a finger briefly. "But I'm not playing," Trev thought, "because of my old mum." He glanced down at the palm of his hand. No star there, he was sure of that. Anyway, he thought, staring at the opponents, when it all goes bad, the referee is a wizard after all.
"Let others boast of martial dash, for we have boldly fought with cash,"
roared the crowd at various pitches and speeds. I mean, Trev thought, he wouldn't switch off his own magic, would he?
"We own all your helmets, we own all your shoes."
I mean, he really wouldn't do that, would he? The only person who could stop it if it all went wrong wouldn't have made a mistake like that.
"We own all your generals. Touch us and you'll lose."
Yes, he has done. He has done just that.
"More porkier, more porkier, more porkier owns the day,"
Trev shouted to quell his own rising panic. He has done that. We all saw him. He's kept his own staff inside the field where you can't do magic. He looked at Andy, and Andy nodded. Yes, he had worked it out as well.
"We can rule you wholesale, touch us and you'll pay."
It is considered in the Stowe Plains that only scoundrels know the second verse of their national anthem, since anyone spending time memorising that would be up to no good purpose. The Ankh-Morpork national anthem, therefore, had a second verse that was deliberately written as ner-ner-ners, and the occasional coherent word desperately trying to stay afloat, on the basis that this is how it would sound in any case. Trev listened to it with even more agony than usual. But everyone joined in cheerful unison for the last line, which everybody knew.
"We can rule you wholesale, credit where it's due."
Glenda, one arm as far across her bosom as it would go, risked a look at what would still probably be called the Royal Box, just as Vetinari raised the goldish-coloured urn and a cheer went up. Ankh-Morpork was not particularly keen on cheering the patrician, but it would cheer money any day of the week. Yet it seemed to Glenda that there was some strange harmonic to the cheer, coming up from under the ground itself, as if the place was one huge mouth. Then the feeling went away, and the day came back.
"Gentlemen, team players to their places," said the Arch-Chancellor of Brazenek haughtily.
Can I have a word with you, sir?" said Trev, sidling up as quickly as possible.
"Ah, yes, Dave Likely's boy," said the former dean. "We are about to play football, Mr. Likely. I'm sure you've noticed."
"Yes, sir. Well, but..."
"Do you know of any good reason why I should hold up the game?" the referee demanded.
Trev gave up. Henry produced a coin from his waistcoat pocket.
"Mostrum," he said.
"Heads,"
said the Arch-Chancellor, and he turned out to be wrong.
"Very well, Mr. Hoggett. And who has the ball?"
Gloing, gloing. Nut picked the ball out of the air and handed it over.
"Me, sir."
"Ah, you are the coach for the Academicals."
"Yes, but a player as well, should it become necessary."
"Gentlemen, you will see that I am placing the ball in the centre of the pitch."
It's true that the Arch-Chancellor, formerly known as Dean, did rather relish the occasion. He took a few steps back, paused for dramatic effect, produced a whistle from his pocket and flourished it. He gave a blow that only a man of that size could give. His face began to twitch and go red. He raised his megaphone to his lips and shouted,
"Any boy who has not brought his kit will play in his pants!"
followed by Ponder Stibbons shouting, "I want to know who gave that to him!" The crowd roared, and you could hear the laugh going away in the distance, rolling down the streets as every listener in the crowded city passed it on, bringing back such memories that at least two people started to forge letters from their mother. In his goal, the librarian swung himself to the top of his posts to get a better look. In his goal, Charlie Barton, goalkeeper for United, methodically lit his pipe. And the man with the biggest problem within the ground that day, apart possibly from Trev, was the editor of the Times, Mr. William de Word, who had not trusted any underling with the reporting of this unique, most prestigious occasion, but wasn't at all sure how it should be done. At the whistle, he'd managed... "The United Chief, should I say Chief? There must be a better word for him, but I can sort that out in the office, does not actually appear to know what to do next. Arch-Chancellor Ridcully, BF... No, I'll fill that in later... has kicked the ball hard towards... Well, actually, it has hit Jimmy Wilkins, formerly of the Miners, who seems uncertain as to what to do with it. No, he's picked it up. He's picked up the ball. The referee, who is the former Dean of Unseen University, has called him over for what I imagine is to be a refresher course in the rules of this new game of football. A megaphone, thought de Word. That's what I need. An extremely big megaphone so I can tell everyone what's going on. The ball has been handed to, let me see, number 69, oh yes, the multi-talented Professor Bengo Macarona, who, according to the regulations, the new rules, is allowed what is known as a free kick from where the infringement took place. And here comes Professor Bengo Macarona for Unseen Academicals, and, oh my word, it has gone right down the pitch at shoulder height, making a noise like a partridge. Check with Nature Notes correspondence on whether I have the correct simile. The ball has hit Mr. Charlie Big Boy Barton in the stomach, with such force as to carry him into the back of the net. What a display. And this would appear to be a goal. At least one goal, I should think. And the crowd are on their feet, though technically most of them were there already anyhow, he wrote conscientiously with a journalist's well-known desire to get things right. And yes, they are celebrating the hero of the moment, and the refrain coming from the lips of the Academical supporters in their unique patois seems to be, "One Macarona, there's only one Macarona, one Macaro-na." in his seat, the university's master of the music fumbled for his notebook and wrote down rapidly, "Macarona unum est, certes macarona est," and couldn't wait to get back to the choir. "No, no, something seems to be happening. Macarona has left the pitch and is talking animatedly to the crowd. He appears to be haranguing them. Those he has been talking to look subdued." At this point, one of the editor's assistants hurried over with a brief digest of what had transpired on the other side of the pitch. De Word wrote quickly, hoping that his homemade shorthand would not fail him. "With that hot-blooded resolve that is so lovably typical of the native genuine, Professor Macarona is apparently insisting that any celebratory chanting should include his full name and full list of honours, and is helpfully writing them down. There also appears to be a bit of a hiatus around United's goal, as some of Charlie Barton's teammates help him find his pipe, and also, it transpires," the editor of the Times liked the word transpire, "the other half of the pork pie it transpired he had been eating at the time the goal was scored. It appears that, not unlike many of us, he had underestimated the speed of the new ball. And now the ball appears to be back in the centre of the pitch, where there is another argument going on." "But they've just scored a goal," said Mr. Hoggett.
"Yes, quite so," said the former dean, wheezing gently. "That means they get to kick off next."
"That means we don't, but we've just lost a goal."
"Yes, that's what the rules say."
"But that's not fair. We want to kick. They kicked it last."
"But it's not about the kicks, Mr. Hoggett, it's what you do with them."
And Arch-Chancellor Ridcully runs towards the ball. He turns swiftly and has kicked the ball towards his own goal. The editor wrote furiously, "Almost all of United's team are running up to take advantage of this strange faux pas. Not entirely cognizant," the editor liked that word too, it was so much better than aware, "but the famous librarian of Unseen University has just..." He stopped, blinked, and grabbed one of his assistants, who had turned up with a full list of Bengo Macarona's honours, and pushed him down in the chair. "Write down everything that I say," he shouted, "and I hope your shorthand is better than mine, and if it isn't, you'll be sacked in the morning. This is insane." "They did it on purpose. I'll swear they did it on purpose. He kicked the ball directly at his own goalkeeper, knowing, I swear, that he could take advantage of the librarian's renowned upper body strength to throw the ball almost the entire length of the pitch. And there is Bengo Macarona, more or less unnoticed by his opponents, heading towards the missile while United have streamed away from their citadel, like the ill-fated Marinids during the First Prodostian War." The editor liked to think of himself as a classicist. "I've never seen anything like it," he shouted at his almost deafened assistant. "They've got United all in the wrong place. And there goes Macarona. The ball appears to be attached to his feet. And there ahead of him appears to be the only member of the luckless United squad that knows what's going on, Mr. Charles Big Boy Barton, who nevertheless is staggering out of the goalmouth like the giant Octopal upon seeing the hordes of the Myrmidons." The editor fell silent, forgetting everything as the ground between the two men shortened by the moment. "Oh, no," he said. There was a huge cheer from the crowd. "What happened?" said the assistant, pencil poised. "Didn't you see it? Didn't you see it?" said the editor. His hair was dishevelled, and he looked like a man nearing madness. "Macarona ran round him. I don't know how the ball stayed at his feet."
"Do you mean he dodged past him, sir?" said the assistant.
The noise of the crowd would have been incandescent had it been visible.
"Another goal," said the editor, slumping. "Two goals in as many minutes." "No, he didn't dodge him, he ran around him. Twice, and I'll swear, ended up going faster." "Ah, yes," said the assistant, still writing. "I went to a lecture about that sort of thing once. It was about how things don't hit the world turtle, sir. It was like a slingshot effect. He may have picked up additional speed as he rounded the goalkeeper's enormous girth, sir." "And listen to the crowd roar," said the editor. "And write it down." "Yes, sir, that would be 1 Professor Macarona, D. Thou Bug, D. Mouse Chub, Magistaludorum QIS, Octavium Ons, PHGK Blit, DMSK, Mac, D. Thou Bra, Visiting Professor in Chickens, Yarn the Conqueror University, Floor 2, Shrimp Packers Building, Genua, Primo Octo Dukes, Visiting Professor of Blit Slude Exchanges Al Carley, KCBFJ, Reciprocating Professor of Blit Theory Unki, D. Thou Unki, Didymus Supremius Unki, Emeritus Professor in Blit Substrata Determinations Chubb, Chair of Blit and Music Studies, Quirm College for Young Ladies.
There's only one Professor Macarona D. Thou Bug, D. Mouse Chub, Magister Ludorum QIS, Octavium Ons, PHGK Blit, DMSK Mac, D. Thou Bra, Visiting Professor in Chickens, Yarn the Conquery University, Floor 2, Shrimp Packers Building, Genua, Primo Octo Dukes, Visiting Professor of Blit, Slewed Exchanges, Al-Khali, KCBFJ, Reciprocating Professor of Blit Theory, Unki, D. Thou Unki, Didymus Supremius Unki, Emeritus Professor in Blit Substrata Determinations, Chubb, Chair of Blit and Music Studies, Quirm College for Young Ladies. There's only one Professor Bengo Macarona, D. Thou Bug, D. Mouse Chub, Magus Ludorum QIS, Octavium Ons, PHGK Blit, DMSK, Mac, D. Thou Bra, Visiting Professor in Chickens, Yarn the Conquery University, Floor 2, Shrimp Packers Building, Genua, Primo Octo Dukes, Visiting Professor of Blit, Slewed Exchanges, Al-Khali, KCBFJ, Reciprocating Professor of Blit Theory, Unki, D. Thou Unki, Didymus Supremius Unki, Emeritus Professor in Blit Substrata Determinations, Chubb, Chair of Blit and Music Studies, Quirm College for Young Ladies, only one Professor Bengo Macarona, D. Thou Bug, D. Mouse Chubb, Magus Ludorum QIS, Octavium Ons, PHGK Blit, DMSK, Mac, D. Thou Bra, Visiting Professor in Chickens, Yarn the Conquery University, Floor 2, Shrimp Packers Building, Genua, Primo Octo Dukes, Visiting Professor of Blit, Slewed Exchanges, Al-Khali, KCBFJ, Reciprocating Professor of Blit Theory, Unki, D. Thou Unki, Didymus Supremius Unki, Emeritus Professor in Blit Substrata Determinations, Chubb, Chair of Blit and Music Studies, Quirm College for Young Ladies, but wouldn't he be off the side, sir? That would indeed appear to be the complaint of the luckless warriors of United, said the editor. They are clustering around the referee, and what would I give to be a fly on that wall? There is no wall, sir. It would seem... And the editor stopped dead. Who is that? What is that, sir? Look over there at the stands. The upper-class stands, I might add, to which we were not invited. The sun usefully took this opportunity to appear from behind the clouds, and the bowl of the hippo seemed to fill with light. That's the micromail girl, sir, said the assistant. Even some of the protesting United team were looking up at the stands now. She hurt the eyes, but they were dragged towards it again. "I've got her picture on my bedroom wall," said the assistant. "Everyone's been looking for her," he coughed. "They say it doesn't chafe, you know." Now all the footballers on the field, bar the unfortunate Charlie Barton, who was having a dizzy spell, were clustered around the referee, who said, "I repeat, it was a perfectly acceptable goal. A trifle unkind and showy, perhaps, but nevertheless entirely within the rules. You've watched the unseen lad's training. The game moves about. It doesn't send you a clax to tell you what's happening next." A voice a little lower down said, "It is an elementary mistake to believe that even the most doughty keeper of the net can single-handedly defend against the full might of the opposing team." This was Nutt.
"Mr. Nutt, you are not supposed to tell them that sort of thing," said Ridcully.
Mr. Hoggett looked downcast, a man betrayed by team history and expectations.
"I can see we've got a lot to learn," he said.
Trev pulled Nutt off to one side.
"And this is where it all goes bad," he said.
"Oh, come now, Mr. Trev. We're doing very well. Bengo is, anyway.
I'm not watching him. I'm watching Andy, and Andy is watching Bengo. They're biding their time. They're letting the poor old buggers get into a hell of a fix, and then they'll just take over."
And then Trev was given a short lesson in why wizards are wizards.
"I have a modest proposal, and I wonder if you will hear me out, referee. While we at Unseen University are absolute novices, we have had rather more time to get to grips with a new football than our current opponents have. Therefore, I propose to give them one of our goals," said Ridcully.
"You can't do that, sir," said Ponder.
"Why? Is it against the rules?"
Ridcully's tone deepened and became noticeably more pompous.
"I ask you, are good sportsmanship, fellowship and generosity against the rules, pray?"
By the end of the sentence, his voice was audible nearly to the very back of the stadium.
"Well, of course, there is nothing against it, sir. There isn't a rule stopping you washing your laundry during the middle of the game, and that is because no one would do it."
"Right. Mr. Hoggett, one of our goals is now yours. We are, as it were, level."
Hoggett, transfixed, looked around at his fellow players.
"Well, there, if you insist, sir."
"Wouldn't dream of taking no for an answer," said Ridcully expansively.
"What in the world made him do that?" said the editor of the Times, as an exhausted runner brought him the news.
"It was a very generous gesture."
"Why did you do it?" said Ponder to Ridcully.
"I'm totally transparent, Stibbons. Generous to a fault, that's me. It's not my fault that they do not know that they are inferior, and this will play on their minds for the rest of the game."
"That's rather cunning, sir."
"Yes, it is, isn't it? I'm rather proud of it. And once again, we get to kick first. No wonder this is such a popular game."
"That was a remarkable piece of psychology there," said Nutt to Trev as they walked back to the sidelines. "Somewhat cruel, possibly, but clever."
Trev said nothing. There was the shrill call of the whistle for the game to resume, followed instantly by the referee screaming,
"A little bit of hail won't hurt you, boy. It's healthy and will do you good."
"That's magic," said Trev. "Should that be happening?"
"No," said Ponder Stibbons behind him. "It's just possession."
"Yes, the game is all about possession, Mr. Trev," said Nutt. Trev looked up again at the stand. There was the shining shape of Juliet, only a few feet away from Vetinari himself, and flanked by Glenda and Pepe. She could be a goddess. "It's never going to happen, is it?" he said to himself. "Not her and a boy from the candle vats. Not really going to happen. Not now." And then Bingo screamed, and it seemed as though every voice in the stadium joined in one communal, "Oh!" And the whistle blew again.
"What happened, sir?" said the editorial assistant.
"Can't exactly be sure. They got the ball to Macarona again, and then he collided with a couple of United players, and they all ended up in a heap."
Nutt, the first to reach the stricken Macarona, looked up at Trev gravely.
"Both patellas dislocated," he said. "We'll need a couple of men to take him down to the Lady Sybil."
The former dean looked around at the clustered footballers.
"So, what happened here, Mr. Shank?"
he said, as perspiration dripped off his chin. Andy momentarily lifted a finger to his forelock.
"Well, sir, I was rushing forward according to the rules to tackle Mr. Macarona, and I had no idea at all that Jimmy the Spoon here had got exactly the same idea and was coming from a different direction, and suddenly we were all there together going arse over tip, if you would excuse my clatchian."
Trev glowered. The look on Andy's face was transparent. He was lying. He knew he was lying. He knew everyone else knew he was lying, and he didn't care. In fact, he rather enjoyed the situation. Andy's boots looked heavy enough to moor a boat.
"They got him like the meat in a sandwich, sir," Trev complained to the referee.
"Can you substantiate that, young man?"
"Well, you can see what's happened to the poor bugger."
"Yes, but do you have any evidence of collusion?"
Trev went blank, and Nutt supplied in a whisper, "Can you prove it was a set-up?"
"Can anyone?"
said the referee, looking around the players. No one could. Trev wondered how many might, were it not for the fact that Andy was standing there, innocent as a shark.
"I'm the referee, gentlemen, and I can only referee what I see, and I saw nothing."
"Yeah, because they made sure of that," said Trev. "Anyway, listen to the crowd. They all saw it."
"Look, they've got boots on them that could strip bark," Ridcully protested.
"Yes, indeed, Mustrom. I mean, sorry, Captain, but as yet there are no rules about which boots should be worn. And, at the very least, these are the boots that have been traditionally worn for the game of football."
"But they're man-traps."
"I can certainly see what you're getting at. But what would you like me to do?" said Henry. "I have a suspicion that if I cancel this match at this point, you and I would not get out of here alive. Because even if we ourselves did escape the wrath of the crowd, we would by no means escape the wrath of Vetinari. The game will continue. Unseen academicals can play a substitute, and I will... let me see." He pulled out a notebook. "Ah, yes, I will award a free kick at the very point where this unfortunate incident took place. And may I add that I will look askance at any future incidents. Mr. Hoggett, I trust that you will make this clear to your team."
"Blow that for a game of soldiers," Trev yelled. "They just took out our best players, and you're going to let them walk away grinning."
But the referee was, after all, the former dean, a man used to head-to-head confrontations with Mustrom Ridcully. He gave Trev a chilly look and turned very deliberately to the Arch-Chancellor and said,
"And I trust you, too, Captain, will impress upon your team that my decisions are final. There will be a 5-minute interlude for you to do this, and can some of you fellows take poor Professor Macarona off the field and see if you can find some quack to look at him?"
A voice behind him bellowed,
"You have one right here, sir."
They turned. A figure slightly larger than life, wearing a top hat and carrying a small bag, nodded at them.
"Dr. Lorne," said Ridcully, "I wouldn't have expected to see you here."
"Really?" said the doctor. "Wouldn't have missed it for the world. Now, some of you men drag him over to that corner, and I'll take a look at him. I'll send my bill to you, shall I, Mustrom?"
"Wouldn't you like to take him somewhere nice and quiet?" said the referee.
"No, fear. I want to keep my eye on the play.
They're getting away with it, said Trev as he walked back to the line. Everyone knows they're getting away with it.
We still have the rest of the team, Mr. Trev, said Nutt, lacing up his boots. He had, of course, made them himself. They looked like foot gloves. And me, of course. I am the first substitute. I promise that I will do my best, Mr. Trev.
Thus far, it had been a rather boring afternoon for the librarian after his one little moment in the sun. It really was rather dull between the goalposts, and he was getting hungry, and so was pleasantly surprised by the appearance of a large banana in front of the goal. It was later agreed that, in a footballing context, mysteriously appearing fruit should have been greeted with a certain amount of caution. But he was hungry, it was a banana, and the metaphysics were sound. He ate it. Glenda, up in the stand, wondered if she was the only one to have seen the startlingly yellow fruit in its trajectory, and then saw, looking up at her from the crowd with a big grin on her face, Mrs. Atkinson, mother of Tosha, himself something of an unguided weapon. Anyone who had ever been in the shove knew her as a perpetrator of all kinds of inventive assaults. She had always got away with it, because no one in the shove would hit an old lady, especially one standing next to Tosha.
"Excuse me," said Glenda, standing up. "I've got to get down there right now."
"Not a chance, love," said Pepe. "It's shoulder to shoulder, a shove and a half."
"Look after Juliet," said Glenda.
She leaned forward and tapped on the shoulder of the nearest man.
"I've got to get to the bottom of this as soon as possible. Mind if I jump?"
He looked past her at the glittering figure of Juliet and said,
"Not at all, if you get your girlfriend to give me a big kiss."
"No, but I'll give you one."
Don't trouble yourself, miss, but come on then, give me your hand."
It was a reasonably fast descent, as she was passed from hand to hand, accompanied by ribaldry, much genial horseplay, and a definite feeling of satisfaction on Glenda's part that she was wearing her biggest and most impenetrable pants. This was slightly modified when she realised that none of the spectators had tried any hanky-panky whatsoever. Elbowing and kicking people out of the way, she reached the goal just as the banana was consumed in one gulp, and stood, panting helplessly, in front of the librarian. He gave her a wide smile, looked thoughtful for a moment, and went over backwards. High up in the stand, Lady Margalotta turned to Vetinari.
"Is that part of the game?"
"I fear not," he said. Ladyship yawned.
"Well, it relieves the boredom, at least. They've spent far more time arguing than playing."
Vetinari smiled.
"Yes, madam, it does look as if football is very much like diplomacy, short periods of fighting followed by long periods of negotiation."
Glenda prodded the librarian.
"Hello? Are you all right?"
All she could hear was a gurgling. She cupped her hands.
"Man, someone down here!"
To another chorus of boos and, because this was Ankh-Morpork, cheers, the travelling committee, which was what the game had now become, hastened over to the unseen academical's goal.
"Someone threw a banana, and I saw who did it, and I think it's poisoned," said Glenda, all in one breath.
"He's breathing very heavily," said Ridcully.
The comment was unnecessary, as the snores were making the goal rattle. He crouched down and put his ear to the librarian's chest.
"I don't think he's been poisoned," he said.
"Why's that, Arch-Chancellor?" said Ponder.
"Because if anyone has poisoned our librarian," said Ridcully, "then, although I am not by nature a vindictive man, I will see to it that this university hunts down the poisoner by every thaumic, mystic and occult means available and makes the rest of their life not only as horrible as they can imagine it, but as horrible as I can imagine it. And you can depend on it, gentlemen, that I have already started work on it."
Ponder looked around until he saw Rincewind.
"Professor Rincewind! You were, I mean, you are, his friend. Can't you stick your fingers down his throat or something?"
Well, no," said Rincewind. "I'm very attached to my fingers, and I like to think of them as attached to me."
The noise of the crowd was getting louder. They were here to see football, not a debate.
"But Dr. Lorne is still here," Rincewind volunteered. "He makes a living out of sticking his hand in things. He's got the knack."
"Ah, yes," said the referee. "Perhaps we can impose upon him to take another patient."
He turned to Ridcully.
"You must play your other substitute."
"That would be Trevor Likely," said the Arch-Chancellor.
"No," blurted out Trev. "I promised my old mum."
"I thought you were part of the team," said Ridcully.
"Well, yes, sir, sort of. Helping out and all that. I promised my old mum, sir, after Dad died. I know I was down on the list, but who would have thought it would have turned out like this?"
Ridcully stared at the sky.
"Well, it seems to me, gentlemen, that we cannot ask a man to break a promise made to an old mum. That would be